This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are we headed for a sixth mass extinction? Experts are asking, and a new paper from MIT brings us some more answers. The possible cause of ecological collapse may surprise you. Here to explain is the author Daniel H. Rothman. He is a professor of geophysics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Rothman is also co-director with Carrie Emanuel of the Lorenz Center at MIT. From Cambridge, Massachusetts, Daniel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while, actually. Now, some biologists say that we are entering a mass extinction, and I've spoken with climate scientists right here on Radio EcoShock that worry about that, too. You and a half dozen other scientists tackled that question in 2015, but for reasons that I hadn't heard before, please explain how a change in microbial life could do us in.
Okay. You're referring to an earlier paper of mine.
Yes.
And this is a paper that appeared in PNAS, and it suggested that the end-Permian extinction, which occurred about 251 million years ago, may have been aided by the evolution of a specific microbe that had the ability to efficiently metabolize a certain form of organic matter and turn it into methane.
All right, but we've been hearing mostly on the past extinctions about macro events like asteroid hits and volcanic eruptions. Are you saying that those are less important, or is this something that you're adding to that discussion?
It's probably the case that the general public thinks that an impact by an extraterrestrial object is the typical cause of mass extinctions. And that's because there is one instance, the extinction at the end of the Cretaceous that gave rise to the extinction of the that killed the dinosaurs, has been shown to be the result of an impact with a bolide. However, none of the other major extinctions have been associated with that kind of evidence. So I think it's fair to say now, 30 to 40 years after the discovery of the possible cause of the KT extinction, that other effects are irrelevant. Indeed, the other effects that are probably most commonly discussed today are also relevant to the one at the end of the Cretaceous, and that's the influence of massive volcanism. We now know, due to some very sophisticated studies in high-resolution geochronology in the last several years, that major episodes of volcanism are associated with at least three of the so-called Big Five mass extinctions. That's the one at the end of the Cretaceous, the one at the end of the Triassic, and the one at the end of the Permian. So the work of mine that you're referring to set out in part to understand how it is that such a major volcanic event might give rise to mass extinction.
Now, to grasp your newly published science, I think we are going to need a lesson on the role of respiration in the carbon cycle. It's something that I find difficult to grasp. Could you give us the basics in that?
Sure. My recent paper in Science Advances that you're referring to is indeed based on how the carbon cycle works. And one can think of the carbon cycle as being a kind of loop. Plants take CO2 out of the atmosphere or the oceans, and they make organic matter. And animals consume that organic matter and use oxygen in the process, usually using oxygen. And bacteria can use other oxidants. And in the process of the metabolism of the organic matter, they return the CO2 to the environment. This back reaction, the return of CO2 to the environment, is known in physiology as respiration. So the carbon cycle is a loop between photosynthesis on the one hand, which takes the CO2 out of the system, and respiration, which returns it back.
Right. So we're talking about your new paper, Thresholds of Catastrophe in the Earth System. It was published in the journal Science Advances in September 2017. And, you know, animal life as we know it began with the Cambrian explosion about half a billion years ago, but less than 100 million years later, 86% of all those species were wiped out in a mass extinction event. Does your paper address some of those causes? I mean, why did it happen?
My paper doesn't address the cause of the and Ordovician extinction, which I believe you're referring to. And so there are commonly thought to be the five biggest extinctions are commonly thought to be the ones at the end of the Ordovician, at the end of the Devonian, that's about 400 million years ago, and then the other three that I mentioned earlier. In fact, my paper doesn't really provide the causes of any of these. Instead, what it does is it points out that, let me backtrack a moment, it sets out to answer a simple question. And the simple question is posed by two basic observations. The first observation is that every time we've seen a major mass extinction, the big five that I just referred to, we know, without any doubt, that there has been associated with it a major disruption of Earth's carbon cycle. That, in a sense, is one of the great achievements of the Earth sciences in the last several decades. Another great achievement of the Earth sciences in the last several decades is the observation that there are a great many perturbations of the carbon cycle throughout geologic time. These often give rise to periods of climate change, as has been detailed in many instances. Now, there's on the order of a few dozen major perturbations of the carbon cycle. When there's a mass extinction, there's always one. However, there's a great many others for which there is no mass extinction. So a natural question to ask is what sets the two groups apart, basically the benign events from the malign events. And so that's what I tried to show. And I did that by analyzing in some detail the ways in which the carbon cycle behaved for all of these events, and 31 in total.
And part of that cycle is carbon stored in the deep ocean, and it's not something we normally think about. I mean, we're interested in what's in the atmosphere. And so how does the deep ocean carbon get into this picture?
In an interesting way. You're right that we don't normally think of carbon in the deep ocean. So the deep ocean actually, compared to the atmosphere, contains vastly more carbon, about 50 times more carbon than the atmosphere contains. And then sediments contain much, much more than that. So a particular form of that carbon interested me in performing both of the studies that you're referring to. And that's the carbon that's basically locked up in the ocean and in organic matter and in sediments as organic matter. That is a consequence of the forward reaction of the carbon cycle, the conversion of CO2 into plant matter. It turns out that some of that plant matter just endures nearly forever. It's that is the carbon cycle of this loop that I described before is not entirely, it's not an entirely closed loop. There's a little bit that leaks out, a very tiny amount, but that tiny amount is environmentally very significant. It ends up sitting around in the ocean for upwards of about 5,000 years, and there's another bit that ends up in sediments for, you know, millions and millions of years. It just, you know, waits for a large tectonic cycle to result in its uplift back into rocks, in which it's then remobilized back into the system. So the upshot is that there's this slow pool of carbon which is effectively reactive, but it reacts at some, you know, a very slow rate for reasons that we don't really understand. And so both papers basically contain within them the assumption that it's possible to remobilize this pool.
And that would be dangerous for us all if it happened. Do you think that human emissions of carbon or our stimulations of carbon through agriculture and all the things that we do could have any role in stimulating a release of that long-held carbon?
That's an interesting question. It's not so easy to make such an extrapolation of these ideas. Remember that we're talking about organic matter that's locked up in the deep ocean. The oceans are voluminous, and to actually make contact with all that organic matter would not only take a new process, but it would take a lot of time, and that's certainly also true for the sediments. So human influence, I don't think you can expect it to have any direct impact on these pools. However, it could have an indirect impact. That is, it could stimulate some other process which could then be responsible for changing the size of these pools.
Well, it's interesting. In your paper, you say, quote, an unstable trajectory would reach its maximum extent roughly 10 to the fourth years after the threshold is breached. And that sounds like the extinction process could be triggered, but we'd still have tens of thousands of years left for human civilization. So what's the worry?
I didn't say we should be worried about that. I mean, I don't think I mentioned worry at all in the paper. So the issue in the paper basically addresses how the carbon cycle works. And so there's this question that one can ask, which I think is a very natural question to ask, is the carbon cycle stable? You know, so let's take, you know, the idea you mentioned in your previous question. Suppose we stimulate the system somehow, unknowingly, you know, we make some change. Are we sure that the carbon cycle will, you know, is going to go on its own merry path independent of that? My suggestion in the paper is that no, we can't be sure. And basically, the analysis doesn't really focus on mechanisms of such stimulation, but it basically asks under what conditions lead to a carbon cycle that is unstable. And I developed those ideas in the paper, and they are the ones that then lead to the expression of critical thresholds. And those critical thresholds basically act as, you know, what in physical science we would call a stability boundary. So on one side of this boundary, the system is stable. That's the one that we think we have now. And on the other side, it appears unstable.
Okay. So the key question then is, what are these critical boundaries, and would we know if we'd crossed one?
So let's first talk about what the critical boundaries are. So this is the main crux of the paper. Right. One of them has long been hypothesized, and that's the following. It's long been thought, going back to the earliest days in which people, you know, theorized about mass extinction, and I would date that back to the 18th century. Right? The idea is that the environment changes too fast for ecosystems to keep up with. Right? So that implicitly suggests that there is a critical rate of change. Beyond that critical rate is not a good thing, right? So if you study the geologic past, what you find out is that, well, you know, this is, you know, possibly true, but then what is that critical rate? And so one of the contributions of my paper is to identify that critical rate, and it comes through a combination of theoretical reasoning and you know, building of a database and analyzing the data. But that's only part of the puzzle, because now if we try to ask ourselves, you know, as you said earlier, should we worry about this? And when I say we and a worry, that I'm basically saying, well, there's a human time scale. Let's define a human time scale to be on the order of centuries. And on the order of centuries, does the rate really matter? So let's imagine that we even make that an even tighter period. Let's say during this discussion, the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere go up by a few parts per million. You know, we will hang up our phones. Your listeners will go back and outside after being inside, and they will not notice at all. The carbon dioxide levels will have gone up a few ppm, and no organism will notice the difference. However, the rate of change, that is the amount by which it increased divided by the time over which it changed, would be astronomical compared to any event in the geologic past. So does that mean that we should really care about the rate? And it means no, that we shouldn't if we're concerned with a very short event. And so that the idea in the paper, which is proposed, is that for short events, what matters is the amount of the change rather than the rate of the change. So I was referring earlier to an effectively infinite rate, but it's not dangerous because it's of only a small amount. And then the paper goes a little bit further because, you know, there's this question of a critical rate at long time scales and then a critical size or amount at short time scales. And the question really is, how does one identify them? So what the paper does is it derives a relation between those two. It shows how to predict the critical size of a fast perturbation from the critical rate of a slow perturbation given one other quantity, and that quantity is the time scale at which changes are damped out by the carbon cycle. And that leads to a very simple relation, and the paper finds the critical rate through a combination of observation and theory. The time scale comes from an understanding of how the carbon cycle works, and then that leads to a prediction for the critical amount. That amount is basically corresponds to on the order of 300 gigatons of carbon added to the oceans. Since the Industrial Revolution, we've added about 150. Any compilation or any prediction of how much will be added over the next, over the course of the present century suggests that at least another 150 will be added, and that would bring us beyond the predicted threshold.
So you are saying that in the direction we're going now, we are going to cross the threshold where a mass extinction event would be more likely.
Correct. And a more precise reading would say the following. Sometime during the present century, we will pass the threshold. We will effectively have crossed our best understanding of where a stability boundary in the carbon cycle might lie. And the question is, what happens next? Well, it turns out that the damping timescale of the carbon cycle is about 10,000 years, and so too would be the development of any instability within the carbon cycle. So that means that any deleterious effects that would be developing as a consequence of passing that threshold would play out over a long time. Now, what they would lead to and how fast they become, you know, serious is an entirely open question. So, I mean, we have no real conception of how this system works. This is essentially, at this point, an abstract idea of there being a stability threshold and the understanding that the other side would put us in a kind of unknown territory. How that works is a subject of, you know, something that requires, you know, more research.
How are scientists going to use the work that you've just published?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's been out there on the internet now for 6 weeks, and, you know, things don't develop that fast, so I can't say, right? So let me see if I can answer you nevertheless. On the part of this scientist, I am motivated to use the empirical observations of this paper to devise a theory for what happens when you cross the stability boundary. I'm sure other people will be interested in doing the same, but there's another benefit or application or understanding of this paper that I think is important to impart. In earth science, there's a very active part of earth science which studies the past. People interested in climate science think of this as, you know, paleoclimate. But as a subject of basic science, it's basically one of earth history. You know, how did the earth develop into what it is today? How did life develop into what it is today? And how did the two co-develop? It's sometimes referred to as a co-evolution problem. In this coevolution problem, there is always the question of, okay, you have this event like the end Permian extinction, which plays out over, you know, perhaps 60,000 years. It's between 10,000 and 100,000 years, right? How do we use that kind of knowledge to inform what is happening today over a period of centuries? So my paper provides a solution to that problem. And to me, that's been a very significant problem for some time, because geologically speaking, in geologic time, there's lots of changes, like the 31 changes I referred to earlier. But how they inform what's going on today has never been clear, because they're slow compared to the rapid changes of today. So I think, you know, if nothing else, my paper suggests that there's a new way of looking at the old events, you know, the events in the past, and extracting, you know, information of contemporary significance.
As an aside, I know you've done some research into the properties of carbon in storage. Do you think carbon capture and storage is a workable technology?
You know, it's going on now, and I, you know, some people think it's successful. my own opinion is that it's a technology which should be considered seriously because, you know, if you were to ask me, you know, how do we avoid the crisis that I'm pointing out as possible? Well, there is a very simple suggestion, and that's to put less CO2 into the atmosphere. And among the many ways of putting less CO2 into the atmosphere is to bury some of it into the ground. And so, I mean, it's certainly something that should be considered.
And could you please tell us about the Lorenz Center and your own Rothman Group at MIT?
I'd be delighted to. Thanks for asking. So the Lorenz Center is a kind of climate think tank that I co-founded along with my colleague, Kerry Emanuel. And our objective in founding the Lorenz Center has been to feature climate science as a curiosity-driven enterprise. We all understand that an understanding of climate is of huge practical importance, and you know the ways in which the climate may change, you know, has a profound impact on our lives and successive generations. But in this discussion, it's somehow been lost that we don't really understand the system that well, and that we need to make predictions as well as we can, but there's more to this science than merely making predictions. There's also developing a better understanding. And the development of a better understanding comes from inspiring, you know, the best young people, the best minds in science, to come join the effort. And so what we've done at MIT is to create this center, the Lorenz Center, to attract people to this effort. And to do that, we're trying to seek private funding and to build an endowment. And it's also of interest to point out why we call it the Lorenz Center. The name Lorenz is the name of our late colleague Ed Lorenz, who is not only a meteorologist and a climate scientist, but perhaps best known for his development of the theory of chaos. And this is an interesting example in which a scientist interested in understanding the natural world around him, specifically the weather and whether it was predictable, made fundamental impacts that pervade all of science because he was trying to ask under what conditions might one be able to predict the evolution of a system and under what conditions might one not be able to predict it. The not being able to predict category falls under the rubric of chaos, and it's had tremendous influence on science in general in the last half century. And we would hope to carry on that tradition by attracting bright young people to the world of climate science, in which they'll make contributions not only to climate science itself, but also to science in general. Within my own group, what we do is we basically apply mathematics to problems like these and to others, and we're particularly interested in the kinds of dynamical systems that Lorenz studied to such great profit.
We have been talking with Daniel H. Rothman, professor of geophysics and co-director of the Lorenz Center at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His paper, Thresholds of Catastrophe in the Earth System, is open access, so you can read it for yourself. You can find links to that and much else that we've discussed in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Daniel, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thanks very much for inviting me on the program.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Isn't Daniel Rothman a great scientific mind? There is so much to what he just said. I recommend you download or listen to that interview again. That's easily done from my blog for this week's show at ecoshock.org. You can play it right on the page, or you can download it and listen to it later. I am not a scientist, as you know, but I would like to discuss this interview with Dr. Rothman. These are my own opinions, and any errors are mine alone. Before we get to the nagging questions about what drives extinction, let me emphasize what may have slipped by in this interview. If I understand things correctly, in an earlier work, Daniel Rothman studied changes in microbial life at the sea bottom that can increase releases of carbon or methane. We all want to talk about asteroids or volcanoes or human emissions, things we can see. But large-scale changes may come about by forces unseen. Microbes may find our carbon loading as a new opportunity, whether at the sea bottom or newly thawed land in Canada, Alaska, and Siberia, the microbial world may intervene heavily in our history.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. But our guest Daniel Rothman is now publishing about very different things. As you heard in this interview, his new paper addresses a long-held theory about how climate change can lead to mass extinction. It has happened at least 5 times in Earth's history. The explanation often given, including by some guests here on Radio EcoShock, is that plants and animals are not able to keep up with the pace of climate change. Conditions change too fast, and species go extinct. Rothman tells us that is not the case, or at least not the primary driver of mass extinction. His in-depth studies of the carbon cycle going back hundreds of millions of years gives a different result. It is the amount of change that drives extinction, rather than the speed of change. That is a fundamental point, and it might reorient future science and perhaps public policy. But I am cautious about this result, precisely because Dr. Rothman is talking about one of the slow, grand cycles on this planet. Carbon is taken up by plants and then released as they die, and that's called respiration. The rate of respiration is not equivalent to carbon consumption, partly because some animals and plants sink to the bottom of the sea. Their carbon may rest there for centuries or much longer. It's like a leak in the carbon system. As a result, there's a huge amount of carbon held in the deep sea bottom, much more than found in the atmosphere. My understanding from this interview is that when thresholds are reached, microbes at the sea bottom can change towards releasing more carbon or even methane, which is many times more potent as a warming gas. But this change in the carbon cycle, Rothman says, is not instant or even likely in coming generations. Studies of past extinction events reveal that when a threshold is reached, the process change may not trigger a global event until perhaps 10,000 years later. This is not the stuff of the near-term extinction crowd. But then Rothman says, we don't really know how the carbon system works. Despite a century of scientific study and concentrated work in the last couple of decades, we still don't know, and that is very dangerous. At least with this study, Rothman is able to tell us what the threshold is. The level of carbon that could trigger the big slow release can be measured in gigatons of carbon added to the ocean. He says 300 gigatons of carbon added to the seas would do it. We've added 150 gigatons since the Industrial Revolution began, and most scientists expect we will put the other 150 gigatons in the seas by the end of this century. My take on this interview is that by the year 2100, we will indeed reach the trigger point for a release of those deep ocean stores of carbon. But the impact may not be evident for a very long time. If the carbon cycle change takes 10,000 years, it is like saying when humans first started farming, we began climate warming. That was 10,000 years ago or so. Of course, there are scientists who say that is true. Agriculture began a slow climate change. But in this case, the result 10,000 years later would be mass extinction, a situation humans would be unlikely to survive. It's like a long-term curse on the distant future. Meanwhile, right now, we are running a whole new experiment with atmospheric chemistry. The rate of our addition of carbon is unheard of. Even conservative reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change say we won't have to wait long for climate disasters to become the new normal. My uneducated guess is that we are facing multiple processes. There is a very long-term cycle involving deep-sea carbon reserves, but everything else I get from climate science suggests there are also fast-moving operations which can destabilize weather, remap the coastline by the end of this century, and sooner than that. We need to know a lot more about fast and slow climate drivers and the relationships, if any, between them. We'll just have to keep going with research, and Radio EcoShock until we get it. But already, there is enough evidence in the melting poles, record set, and continuing disasters to demand rapid decarbonization. In the words of a recent idiot, do something.
Radio EcoShock. Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.